come back to our chapter that we began last time, the divine work. And Sri Aurobindo continues his advancing argument here. In an advanced stage of the yoga, it is indifferent to the seeker, in the sense of any personal preference, what action he shall do or not do. Even whether he shall act or not is not decided by his personal choice or pleasure. And you'll remember that last time we quoted the Gita, in the fourth chapter, the 20th shloka, having abandoned all attachment to the fruits of his works, ever satisfied without any kind of dependence. He does nothing, though he engages in action. And then also in the third chapter, the 22nd shloka, I have no work that I need to do in all the three worlds. Continues, I abide, verily, in the paths of action. So the divine is the supreme Purushottama, and the person who has reached spiritual liberation can each continue as a transcendent person and as a liberated individual to conduct work in the world without attachment and without reference to ego, as we will see immediately. Always, he is moved to do whatever is in consonance with the truth, or whatever the demands, pardon me, or whatever the divine demands through his nature. Remember in the Gita, setting up the idea of karma yoga, the yoga of divine works, the yoga as a path that leads you into communion with the divine actively. There is the question of what you do with yourself in the work. And Krishna leads Arjuna to recognize that in the offering, yourself disappears. Your ego diminishes. Egoism and then ego get out of the way, and there is simply the consecrated offering that comes from you to me. You are not abolished as a soul, as a seen, awakened individual. But more and more, what you do comes to me. So ultimately, with the erasure of the egoistic fence between you and the divine, the work that you're doing is motivated by the divine. You simply conduct the action that is poured through you, and you recognize that you are perhaps at first an instrument, as Sri Aurobindo writes in The Mother, then later a channel, finally a child of the divine. Sri Aurobindo continues, a false conclusion is sometimes drawn from this state of liberation, remember. A false conclusion is sometimes drawn from this, that the spiritual man, accepting the position in which fate or God or his past karma has placed him, content to work in the field and cadre of the family, clan, caste, nation, occupation which are his by birth and circumstance, will not, and even perhaps ought not, to make any movement to exceed them, or to pursue any great mundane end. Since he has really no work to do, since he has only to use works, no matter what works, as long as he is in the body, in order to arrive at liberation, or having arrived, only to obey the supreme will and do whatever it dictates, the actual field given him is sufficient for the purpose. Once free, he has only to continue working in the sphere assigned to him by fate and circumstances till the great hour arrives, we can at last disappear into the infinite. To insist on any particular end or to work for some great mundane object is to fall into the illusion of works. It is to entertain the error that terrestrial life has an intelligible intention and contains objects worthy of pursuit. The great theory of illusion, which is a practical denial of the divine in the world, even when in idea it acknowledges the presence, is once more before us. So, this idea of a spiritual release, the spiritual man, in other words, not the person who lives an ethical life, but who lives in the reality of the consciousness of the Atman, of Brahman, moves away, lets the body, in a sense, exhaust itself and fall away. Works may happen, but there is no attachment to it. No personal motivation gives them impetus. Because if you were to intend to do something in an unintelligible and unreal world, then you would be falling victim to all the constraints that Maya would place you in. We are back to this great theory of illusion. The truth that Advaita Vedanta asserts is that there is only one reality. Sri Aurobindo agrees with that, but does not distinguish, does not draw rigid lines separating transcendence from universe or from individual. To Sri Aurobindo, all this is well and good. All of this is meant for a purpose, as we will see further. But here, this idea is that any possibility of work in the mundane world, in other words, the world which is ordinary, which comes and goes, which is transient, which there is no permanence, etc., is a foolish thing to undertake. There could be no design in this, and Sri Aurobindo very much insists that there is a secret design built into the evolutionary power of the world. So Sri Aurobindo continues, but the divine is here in the world, not only in status, but in dynamis, not only as a spiritual self and presence, but as power, force, energy, and therefore a divine work in the world is possible. It's not only sat, that which really is, but it is also what is conscious, an existence conscious of itself. And no consciousness is absent of power. Power to seize upon its possibilities, power to express itself must be part of that. So chit tapas or chit shakti is a reality. And if it is here in this world as well, because it is truly omnipresent, then it must be here with some intent behind its manifestation. Because it doesn't manifest without will. It is will that brings it into power. Tapas means will, forcefully compressing the infinite into a composite image of itself in which all of it exists. So how does the infinite become finite? Through an act of will. What is encoded inside that finitude must uncoil, must express itself. And therefore, if the divine went in, then coming out, a divine work must at some point in the evolution become possible. It is possible. There is no narrow principle, no field of cabined action that can be imposed on the Karma Yogin as his rule or his province. This much is true, that every kind of works, whether small to man's imagination or great, petty in scope or wide, can be equally used in the progress towards liberation or for self-discipline. This much is also true, that after liberation, a man may dwell in any sphere of life and in any kind of action and fulfill there his existence in the divine. According as he is moved by the Spirit, he may remain in the sphere assigned to him by birth and circumstances, or break that framework and go forth to an untrammeled action which shall be the fitting body of his greatened consciousness and higher knowledge. To the outward eyes of men, the inner liberation may make no apparent difference in his outward acts. Or, on the contrary, the freedom and infinity within may translate itself into an outward dynamic working so large and new that all regards are drawn by this novel force. If such be the intention of the Supreme within him, the liberated soul may be content with a subtle and limited action within the old human surroundings, which will in no way seek to change their outward appearance. But it may too be called to a work which will not only alter the forms and sphere of its own external life, but leaving nothing around it unchanged or unaffected, create a new world or a new order. So, when the surrender is complete, when the spiritual fulfillment is full, has pushed beyond liberation and realization into expressing itself in the world, then one may reside in the familiar surroundings. One may move as is bidden within, as is directed by divine fiat. And this is, of course, what Sri Aurobindo did. This is his own experience in these last sentences, as contrasted with other spiritual figures who may have had realization but didn't budge. So many, it would be hurtful to name them, who were content to remain in the moorings in which the Enlightenment came, and did not move out of it. But for Sri Aurobindo, his personal life became wedded to the life of the collective, the idea of a collective integral yoga fashioned itself into an ashram which was meant to be the fulcrum of world change, just what he says here. Leaving nothing around it unchanged or unaffected, create a new world or a new order. This is the power of his own manifesting spirit. This is the Chit Shakti working within him to new make not only the structure of his personal vehicle, mind, life, and body, the Adhara, but to greaten its impact on the world by making it radiate its force from a center in Pondicherry, which became the ashram named after him. Then there's a break, and then the next paragraph begins. A prevalent idea would persuade us that the sole aim of liberation is to secure for the individual soul freedom from physical rebirth in the unstable life of the universe. If this freedom is once assured, there is no further work for it in life here or elsewhere, or only that which the continued existence of the body demands or the unfulfilled effects of past lives necessitate. In other words, once you get this liberation, then you wind down the clock, you drain the battery, because what have you to do with any of that? You live complete, self-shining in the light of the awakened spirit. This little rapidly exhausted or consumed by the fire of yoga will cease with the departure of the released soul from the body. The aim of escape from rebirth, now long fixed in the Indian mentality as the highest object of the soul, has replaced the enjoyment of a heaven beyond, fixed in the mentality of the devout by many religions as their divine lure. One calls to moksha, the other calls to heaven. Indian religion also upheld that earlier and lower call when the gross external interpretation of the Vedic hymns was the dominant creed, and the dualists in later India also have kept that as part of their supreme spiritual motive. So, this is what the Bhagavad Gita objects to in its second chapter, verses 42-43, again in the sixth chapter, shloka 44, and again in the eighth chapter, shloka 28, that is not the real secret of the Veda, but that became the externalized Vedic path of the sacrifice. That does not take you to enlightenment. Krishna is forcefully telling Arjuna again and again. But that is a goal. And that kind of ideal where one can rest in heaven and be near unto God becomes part of Madhava's philosophy, Dvaita Vedanta, separating God from the soul. The soul really does exist, but exists in an inferior state of being and is not identical with the divine, and so lives, if in heaven, at a lower level and cannot really invade the splendor of that divine kingdom wherein lies the deity itself. Undoubtedly, a release from the limitations of the mind and body into an eternal peace, rest, silence of the spirit makes a higher appeal than the offer of a heaven of mental joys or eternized physical pleasures, but this too, after all, is a lure. Its insistence on the mind's world weariness, the life being's shrinking from the adventure of birth, strikes a chord of weakness and cannot be the supreme motive. The desire of personal salvation, however high its form, is an outcome of ego. It rests on the idea of our own individuality and its desire for its personal good or welfare, its longing for a release from suffering, or its cry for the extinction of the trouble of becoming, and makes that the supreme aim of our existence. So before we move on, the purpose of the cosmos is not for the individual to quit it. The purpose of existence is not for the individual to cancel itself out. The purpose of existence, transcendent, universal, and individual, is that all three must be fulfilled. The integral yoga recognizes that and insists that the perfected individual become cosmic in dimension and transcendent in its source, be aware of all three, and move as the divine will dictates from the dominance of one term over the other throughout the course of its existence. It is not aiming at individual release. Individual release is significant, is central to our task. We cannot accomplish any of the larger aims of yoga without it, but it is not our final resting place. To rise beyond the desire of personal salvation is necessary for the complete rejection of this basis of ego. If we seek the divine, it should be for the sake of the divine and for nothing else, because that is the supreme call of our being, the deepest truth of the spirit. The pursuit of liberation, of the soul's freedom, of the realization of our true and highest self, of union with the divine, is justified only because it is the highest law of our nature, because it is the attraction of that which is lower in us to that which is highest, because it is the divine will in us. That is its sufficient justification and its one truest reason. All other motives are excrescences, minor or incidental truths or useful lures which the soul must abandon the moment their utility is past and the state of oneness with the Supreme and with all beings has become our normal consciousness and the bliss of that state our spiritual atmosphere. Let's go back to that unusual word, excrescences, not to be confused with other words that begin with excra. An excrescence is a growth out. It's an unwanted or a superfluous part of our being, like a wart on a finger. Often, we see this desire of personal salvation overcome by another attraction, which also belongs to the higher turn of our nature, and which indicates the essential character of the action the liberated soul must pursue. It is that which is implied in the great legend of the Amitabha Buddha, who turned away when his spirit was on the threshold of nirvana and took the vow never to cross it while a single being remained in the sorrow and the ignorance. Okay. The Amitabha Buddha is not the Buddha, Siddhartha, Gautama Buddha that we knew. Our Buddha, the one we know about who lived in North India, left his body physically around 385 BCE. We don't begin to hear about Amitabha Buddha until Buddhism reaches China, Japan, etc., etc., probably around the 2nd century CE. So 300-400 years later, we begin to get some note about that. By the way, the word Amitabha means unmeasured splendor. And this is the idea of a Buddha who refused enlightenment until every sentient being, every blade of grass was enlightened before him, that he would stand apart. But there he is. He's created a world, a pure land, Buddha Kshetra, the field of the Buddha, translated in English as pure land Buddha. So this is a supraphysical idea. This is a plane of Buddhahood, some other universe perhaps, some other time, which is important because all beings there live in enlightenment. This is another idealized realm which is familiar to us, but does not exist upon this earth. This Amitabha Buddha was not speaking as someone on our globe. And let's also note that it was still later that Amitabha Buddhism made its appearance and figured in Vajrayana Buddhism. So, that idea, though, that I cherish all beings and all beings are coming with me, I'm not leaving them, that's the important thing to remember about this. Sri Aurobindo goes on, it is that which underlines the sublime verse of the Bhagavata Purana. I desire not the supreme state with all its eight cities, nor the cessation of rebirth. May I assume the sorrow of all creatures who suffer and enter into them so that they be made free from grief. We need to find that source. I couldn't find that citation. The Bhagavata Purana is like 18 books long. It is that which inspires a remarkable passage in the letter of Swami Vivekananda. I have lost all wish for my salvation, wrote the great Vedantin. May I be born again and again and suffer thousands of miseries so that I may worship the only God that exists, the only God I believe in, the sum total of all souls, and above all, my God, the wicked, my God, the miserable, my God, the poor of all races, of all species, is the special object of my worship. He who is the high and low, the saint and the sinner, the god and the worm, him worship, the visible, the knowable, the real, the omnipresent. Break all other idols, in whom there is neither past life, nor future birth, nor death, nor going, nor coming, in whom we always have been, and always will be one, him worship. Break all other idols. This I did find. This is in his collected works, volume 1, page 106, in his epistles. He had written on the 9th of July, 1897, to a friend in America. Americans had found Swami Vivekananda to be unworthy of their respect. So he listened and read the complaints of his friend and was writing back this lengthy, beautiful letter, which will reveal to you his spirit. I recommend that you go find it. Again, volume 1. In the old edition I had, page 106, I think. 9 July, which is important to some of us. It's the day we were granted the relics of Sri Aurobindo. The last two sentences contain indeed the whole gist of the matter. The true salvation, or the true freedom from the chain of rebirth, is not the rejection of terrestrial life or the individual's escape by a spiritual self-annihilation, even as the true renunciation is not the mere physical abandonment of family and society. It is the inner identification with the divine, in whom there is no limitation of past life and future birth, but instead the eternal existence of the unborn soul. He who is free inwardly, even doing actions, does nothing at all, says the Gita. For it is nature that works in him under the control of the Lord of nature. Equally, even if he assumes 100 times the body, he is free from any chain of birth or mechanical wheel of existence, since he lives in the unborn and undying spirit and not in the life of the body. Therefore, attachment to the escape from rebirth is one of the idols which, whoever keeps, the sadhaka of the integral yoga must break and cast away from him. For his yoga is not limited to the realization of the transcendent beyond all world by the individual soul. It embraces also the realization of the universal, the sum total of all souls, and cannot, therefore, be confined to the movement of a personal salvation and escape. Even in his transcendence of cosmic limitations, he is still one with all in God. A divine work remains for him in the universe. Even if he assumes 100 times the body, he is free. This is an important encouragement for you. Work hard. Make the breakthrough in this life. You can find your soul here and now. You can live in what she calls the psychic being. You can live in that aspect of your mortal being here and retire from work in the silence of the Atman all at one, because your soul is a manifestation of an individual aspect of that sublime single self, the only thing that really is. And having recovered your sense of self, you need not fear being born and reborn again and again in this world, which seems to be only a field of darkness and suffering. You're making it better. Every time you wake up, you are making this world better. And nothing can cloud your truth of spirit. Even if you plunge into the inconscient, that which has been realized in you will reassert itself and you will emerge fresh. You will emerge even in life. Recover your buoyancy. Remember what is your mission and what drove you here, and continue that work for her, as her representative and as her. You're not divided from her. Did you ever think you could leave the lap of the mother? No. No. She protects you always. So, we'll put a bookmark there and we'll pick it up again next week. On the 24th of April, I didn't have enough time to find an appropriate passage from Savitri for those of you who were with us. I apologize for that error. I have one for you tonight. This is in Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother. Canto 2, the Adoration of the Divine Mother. And this begins, I think, on page 313. illumined by her all-seeing identity. Knowledge and ignorance could strive no more. No longer could the Titan opposites, antagonist poles of the world's artifice, impose the illusion of their twofold screen, throwing their figures between us and her. The wisdom was near, disguised by its own works, of which the darkened universe is the robe. No more existence seemed an aimless fall. Extinction was no more the sole release. The hidden word was found, the long-sought clue. Revealed was the meaning of our spirit's birth, condemned to an imperfect body and mind, in the inconscience of material things, and the indignity of mortal life. A heart was felt in the spaces wide and bare, a burning love from white spiritual founts annulled the sorrow of the ignorant depths. Suffering was lost in her immortal smile. A life from beyond grew conqueror here of death. To err no more was natural to mind. Wrong could not come where all was light and love. The formless and the formed were joined in her. Immensity was exceeded by a look. A face revealed the crowded infinite. Incarnating inexpressibly in her limbs, the boundless joy the blind world forces seek, her body of beauty mooned the seas of bliss. At the head she stands, of birth and toil and fate. In their slow round, the cycles turn to her call. Alone, her hands can change time's dragon base. Hers is the mystery the night conceals. The spirit's alchemist energy is hers. She is the golden bridge, the wonderful fire. The luminous heart of the unknown is she, a power of silence in the depths of God. She is the force, the inevitable word, the magnet of our difficult ascent, the sun from which we kindle all our suns, the light that leans from the unrealized vasts, the joy that beckons from the impossible, the might of all that never yet came down. All nature dumbly calls to her alone, to heal with her feet the aching throb of life, and break the seals on the dim soul of man, and kindle her fire in the closed heart of things. All here shall be one day her sweetness's home. All contraries prepare her harmony. Towards her our knowledge climbs, our passion gropes. In her miraculous rapture we shall dwell. Her clasp shall turn to ecstasy, our pain. Our self shall be one self with all through her. In her confirmed, because transformed in her, our life shall find in its fulfilled response above the boundless hushed beatitudes, below the wonder of the embrace divine. This known as in a thunder flash of God, the rapture of things eternal filled his limbs. Amazement fell upon his ravished sense. His spirit was caught in her intolerant flame. Once seen, his heart acknowledged only her. Only a hunger of infinite bliss was left. All aims in her were lost, then found in her. His base was gathered to one pointing spire. Namaste, Jai Ma.